There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the third episode of the 45th podcast. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm here with my colleagues. Say hi, guys.
Hi, this is Sarah Basha.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson.
All right, guys, it's been a really eventful couple of weeks, as it is every couple of weeks or every couple of days even. But before we get into it, a couple of quick announcements that we're pretty excited about. First of all, thanks to listener demand, and also because there is just too much going on, we are actually going to switch over to weekly programming. So every week in the coming weeks, you will get a new episode of the 45th. Another exciting announcement that we have is that we are setting up a listener call-in number so that our listeners can leave messages. The number is 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. And at the end of the episode, I'll announce the number again. But please feel free to call in, leave your messages, and we're going to pull a few favorite listener messages every week or every couple of weeks and play them and respond to you guys on our episodes. So how are you guys doing? I know, Susan, thank you so much for doing everything you can to be part of this week's episode. You're all the way across the country, holed up in a hotel room trying to record with us. But tell us what you're up to.
Yeah, I'm at the Innocence Conference in San Diego, where it's a conference for all the Innocence networks and affiliates to come together. And I'm here with Claire, actually, from the GIP, Georgia Innocence Project, who, if you listen to Undisclosed, you'll remember from season two.
Yeah, we worked with Claire. Well, she's the one who brought the case to Susan, and they do great work at the Georgia Innocence Project.
Yeah, I'm currently borrowing some sound equipment from Brooke from Actual Innocence. So check out her podcast, too, if you haven't.
Oh, Brooke's there, too. That's awesome.
She is.
Sounds like a family reunion. Sarah, what are you up to?
I've just been busy watching the news like everybody else, and there's so many stories out every day in different directions. It's crazy.
Yeah. We've got a great lineup of issues we want to talk about today. One thing I noted that we are not going to be touching on as I'm looking at our bullets is the healthcare reform bill that is being heavily negotiated and it's just causing all kinds of trouble inside the Beltway. But we will get to it, definitely. It's a really important issue that's going to impact pretty much all of us. So I'm going to start off by giving you guys a quick update on the Executive Order 2.0, which I brought up in the last episode. And I kind of went over the different changes. Well, Executive Order 2.0 has also been shut down by two different judges. First, a judge in Hawaii, U.S. District Judge Derek Watson. He issued a 43-page opinion that basically was a complete sweeping freeze of the order just a few hours before it was supposed to go into effect. What I find interesting about this opinion is that not only did he say that he thought there would be a strong likelihood of success of the people suing the government, and that's why he was freezing, but also he said very specifically that that this order clearly showed a discriminatory purpose. And he also specifically said that the government's argument that because the ban didn't apply to all Muslims, it couldn't be construed as discriminating against Muslims was ridiculous. This is actually what he said. He said, "The illogic of the government's contentions is palpable. The notion that one can demonstrate animus towards any group of people only by targeting all of them at once is fundamentally flawed." In a second ruling, a federal judge in Maryland also ruled against the government, but it's a much narrower ruling that only applies to issuing visas to the countries that are mentioned and not on other instances. But again, he also said that he believes that this executive order was, quote, the realization of the long-envisioned Muslim ban. So there we have it.
Interesting part, Rabia. So I thought it was interesting that they actually looked at the intent and tied in the campaign talk that Trump had about banning Muslims, they tied that in, and it's part of the ruling is that there was an intention for it. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the argument plaintiffs put forward, right? That this has a discriminatory intent, it's unconstitutional, and it's a stumbling block. The administration might have wanted to keep their mouth shut during the campaign about what their intent was. Now, the only difference here now between this and the last one is, last time this happened, is that the administration now is saying that they are going to pursue appeals.
Well, I did say that last time. I believe Trump tweeted it. I'll see you in court.
Oh, okay. You know, well, maybe more serious
people. That's generally what one does when you have a ruling in court. You'll see them in court.
You'll see them in court. Yeah, that's kind of how it happens. He's brilliant. It seems like they are serious about this, about pursuing further appeals. The Department of Justice also issued a statement saying that they would be appealing these decisions. And so one of the very important things to keep an eye on here that might impact this at some point is, because this could go all the way up to the Supreme Court if everybody keeps fighting it, and the Supreme Court nominee, which we're going to talk about later in the episode, is going to be of real consequence to this decision, of course, many others. So any other thoughts on that? I just wanted to update our listeners.
I just felt like it's going in the right direction.
Okay. By killing it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they kind of tweaked some stuff from the first order, obviously removing Iraq and not having the religious minority preference. But essentially, I think it's being called out for what people think it is. I mean, I don't necessarily agree, only because I think it's mixed up with what he had said and what might be required right now as a security move. So it's all part and parcel of that whole vague intent thing and where this falls in terms of what he's been saying all this time and then what's being required by our national security professionals.
Yeah, so I'm conflicted on what's happening in the courts in a few ways, because just the whole notion of deciding a bill like this, deciding constitutionality based on a now president's campaign statements is very problematic. I'm not going to say I'm on the board with saying it can't happen, because I think it can, and I think this is probably definitely is the clearest test case we've ever seen. But on the other hand, where does that stop? I mean, the first bill, the first EO, it was so problematic. It had so many flaws, not even just constitutionally, but like it was just such a messed up bill that it wasn't just based on the campaign statements. In the current version of it, the current iteration for the court, it really kind of is more a pure First Amendment religious discrimination issue. Is this bill intended to discriminate against Muslims? And we're deciding that based on statements made by the president while he was campaigning. I'm very sympathetic to people who are not okay with that and have legal objections to it. I don't know enough about the legal intricacies to know for sure where I fall on it, but I mean, that's a scary place to be as society. That's not for very good reasons. We have not had that happen before where we have the, just campaign trail stuff come in to decide constitutional questions.
So I've been thinking about this, and the use of the word Muslim ban, I feel like the left uses it to get all the Muslims riled up and behind their rallying causes. But my question is this. I think that I actually call it the Disney princess ban, and I'll ask you guys to interpret why. But have you guys watched the cartoon Aladdin, right? The Disney cartoon.
Yeah, of course. 1,000 times, thanks to my daughters.
Right. So what do you notice about the Disney version of Aladdin that's kind of mixed up in terms of its cultural portrayal of Arabs?
I feel like it's going to be a long list.
Yeah. all the tropes are there, right?
Well, no, I thought, and my kids noticed this too, is that, Princess Jasmine looks incredibly Indian. The fact that she's got a tiger called Raja sounds Indian. The palace that they live in looks like the Taj Mahal. So I think a lot of the times
there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion between cultures, what's Indian and what's Arab. So I think this is what I believe is that when Donald Trump said he wants to ban all Muslims, he said that in a very ignorant way, as well-traveled as he is, because when he said all Muslims, he meant the people coming from that part of the world where ISIS is having issues or causing issues. And so he said it very loosely. And then he goes ahead and has to do that when they're having military operations once he's in office, and he has to stick to it. And so it becomes a Muslim ban because that's what he said it was. But then,
okay, but that's, so,
that was said without the realization that all Arabs are not Muslim and all Muslims are not Arab. And so I have an issue with the terminology that's used just because of the background that I have in trying to find the root causes and the drivers behind conflict. And so I think the left is using it to get rally people around their cause. And I think the rest of the people might be using it to subconsciously stop Muslims. And that's probably a popular thought about it. But I think the Trump administration itself cannot really ban Muslims anyway. And I think that was said in an era of ignorance about what exactly is a Muslim. And can you stop a Muslim from Bosnia? Can you stop a Muslim from India? Can you stop a Muslim from China? It's not a Muslim ban. But
So how do you interpret statements like fear of Muslims is rational and we're at war with Islam? That's senior advisors. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree there, but I don't understand how that can not be indication that actually they do think they're at war with Islam because they say they are, and they want to ban all Muslims because they say they do.
And wait a minute, just quickly. Sorry, just because he is too ignorant to realize that most Muslims live outside of the Middle East doesn't mean if he knew that information, it would change his opinion. I feel like that's just, the bigot, surprise, doesn't really know his information. He doesn't know his facts. But if he knew the facts, I don't think it would change. I think if you said, well, 100 million, or I don't know, the most Muslims live in Indonesia, he'd be like, well, then ban them too. But beyond that, I think for me, what's telling, and this was one of the biggest concerns I had, is who he surrounded himself with. We know the administration, and one day I'm going to get into this, of all the different figures who have been connected to the Islamophobic industry, from Gorka. I mean, there's so many of them. Spencer, all these people that, those of us who've been like, busy in Muslim activism for the last 10, 15 years, we know these people. We never thought they would be that mainstreamed, right? Because during the Obama administration, they were kind of sidelined. Now they're in the frickin' White House. He surrounded himself with people who have made a living and whose careers are based on demonizing Muslims. So, but you know what? I think we're going to continue to disagree on that. So we need to move on. I'm just glad the judges agree with me and Susan.
I agree with the judges too. Come on.
Well, you do agree with it, maybe but you don't agree that it's a Muslim ban, and that's what they said.
No, because I think the terminology is just troublesome.
Okay, well, you know. All right, I'm going to move on to a really weird ban that came, I think, early this week. And it was, we first saw this when a couple different airlines tweeted that they were being given directives by U.S. government that now they could know their passengers coming to the United States from 10 different Middle Eastern countries. And I think specific airlines in those countries that serve as the major airlines in those countries, their passengers could no longer carry anything larger, any electronic device larger than a cell phone onto the airplane. So if they have tablets, laptops, any other cameras, other electronic devices, that unless it's medical equipment or a cell phone, they had to be checked in luggage. And there's been a lot of confusion about this because, then the UK followed up, I think, the day after or 2 days after with a similar kind of ban. It's supposed to be a 90-day ban, but it's in response to some kind of a threat. And the weird thing to me about this is, you know, security experts who've been commenting on this are like, how is that supposed to make anybody on a flight safer? Because if somebody has armed an electronic device to be a bomb or to be any kind of an explosive, and they check it, you know, it can still, you know, hurt people. It can still, you know, have impact on the plane. It doesn't make it any safer. On top of which, a cell phone nowadays has pretty much the same, if not more, capabilities as a computer. There's a lot of things you can do with cell phone, including hacking. If you're going to hack, let's say, into the airline system or the navigation or something. Another reason that this ban kind of doesn't work is that they're saying any direct flight coming from these 10 airports, Qatar, Saudi, there's like a list of 10 of them. Well, if somebody wanted to do something on the way over to the United States, all they have to do is catch a layover, you know, somewhere in Europe. And all of us who traveled that part of the world, we know, you know, there's generally a layover somewhere and be on a carrier that's not impacted by this. So, like, nobody really understands the logic in this, and there's not a lot. And I just wonder if this is, having lost on, like, the immigration bans, is this just one more way to, like, harass Muslim passengers?
I don't think so, Rabia. I don't think so.
I trust
the DHS on this one. Okay, and to say that there's an equal threat to stuff that's in the cargo versus in your lap. I mean, people could be actually planning stuff or coordinating it, and it's in the proximity of the other passengers when it's inside the cabin area. Whereas it's in the cargo, I think they probably go through a different screening process before those pieces of luggage are put into the cargo area. So, I mean, don't underestimate the fact that they're probably doing separate checks for stuff that goes into the cargo. So I don't really buy that. And then the other thing is using the word ban, just associating it with the Muslim ban, it just makes it look overall like it's associated. This is a separate DHS move. It's not related to the executive orders. It was done on credible evidence that we had, and also I suppose the UK had, on travel issues that might ensue. And these things have been happening. There was apparently one that was done on a flight from Somalia. There have been several cases. So I look at this separately. And some of the questions I have, if I did have any, is why those countries in particular, like you said, you could circumvent them and go through Europe. It might be that it just makes it easier. But the other thing is, doesn't this really affect business? Because people do a lot of work, well, not substantially maybe, but they do some work on the plane, and it stops professionals who want to get stuff done on their way. And a lot of people do stop doing that. And it just, I think it just creates an atmosphere of anti-business and anti,
Right. But what are those people going to do? They're not going to stop traveling for work. They're just going to choose different carriers. And and I think that might also be one of the incentives here, is pushing business towards other carriers because these carriers are very, very competitive.
Well, there's also the issue of those carriers there's been longstanding disputes, and that those carriers disproportionately have been from subsidies, like national subsidies.
Very high subsidies, yeah.
Yeah.
They're very competitive. It's true. And many of them...
anti-competitive would be the argument, but...
Oh, right, so right,
there,
right.
There
right.
is a theory
with each other.
this is targeted to, not necessarily at Muslims, but to, by other means, combat this, what other countries see as an unfair subsidy to these airlines. And I think this is where Donald Trump's constant lying hurts him, again, like very, in a very concrete way, because it sounds like there probably is a very specific like terror threat, and possibly one that would make sense that it's only it's more of a threat if it's a carry-on versus in the cargo hold when you can't really time when it's going to go off or have less control over the detonation. But at the same time, it also is enacted in a way that specifically seems to help someone who wanted to address these trade issues. So it's hard to tell, and Trump has lost benefit of the doubt, whether this is purely motivated by security or if this is actually a way of using a security threat to enact get a leg up in a trade dispute.
You know what I find interesting is if you look at this this move that they've made, it could very well be our attempt to control the economics of the situation and kind of have people divert their usage of carriers to others. But also, did you notice that the UK didn't ban all of the ones, or didn't, I shouldn't use the word ban, but the UK didn't institute it for countries like Kuwait? And we did. So it makes me wonder, like, what is the reasoning behind that? I know that UK and Kuwait has a long history of, from the days of the colonial days up until now, it's very close ties. And, having grown up there, I just know that it's, everything there is pretty much, from British education to everything else is they have close ties. And I'm wondering how they lifted that, and that yet we have the same one. If it's based on the premise that, there's a threat, then how come the UK lifted on some countries? That baffles me. But then again, I defer to the DHS. I trust them. I think they know what they're doing better than we do.
I mean, I agree there. And I think, Susan hit the nail on the head, is that because of the credibility issues with this administration, it is hard to take everything at face value. And especially when something like this was done with very little transparency and clarity. And although, again, if it's based on like some kind of chatter or intel, they can't obviously be public about everything that they have. So anyhow, it's interesting. It's really been difficult for people. Some of the airlines are trying to enlighten the mood for their passengers by offering other kinds of activities for them. These are long flights. So let's see how this rolls out, and if it really only lasts 90 days, or maybe it'll stop before that.
I thought it was indefinite.
What I've read is that it's 90 days or as long as the threat persists. So, I haven't seen indefinite. October is when one of the airlines has reported that they were told until about mid-October is when they have to do this. All right, another thing that has been on my mind is the skinny budget, which was revealed by the White House, I think about a week ago. And there are a lot of programs on there that are going to be domestically cut. I was devastated to see the U.S. Institute of Peace, where I just finished up a fellowship, completely being eliminated according to that budget. But I don't want to talk so much about the domestic cuts, although you can argue that USIP is not domestic, it's an international organization. But anyway, I want to talk specifically about the cut of about $1 billion to UN peacekeeping. And that's about 40% of the State Department peacekeeping budget. And cutting, eliminating completely hundreds of millions of dollars that we give in poverty and food programs and development programs overseas, including, by the way, all of the funding for UNICEF. We all remember UNICEF, you know, those little boxes we had in grade school as we collected coins in them. And then 28% cuts on all international programs. Now, this is not a final budget. We know this, that we're like somewhere, I think in mid-May is when we're going to get like a fleshed out final kind of budget, and we don't know whether this is going to pass or not. But I am pretty alarmed at seeing the direction this is taking, because what we're seeing is these tremendous, tremendous cuts in peacekeeping, conflict resolution, the management of suffering overseas, but we're seeing this huge increase in defense funding, $54 billion. And for me, I feel like there's a major disconnect with the administration. They don't understand that when they're talking about boosting defense for the United States, like how important these peacekeeping programs are to that, and how by removing so much funding, hundreds of millions, up to a billion from the UN, they're really going to further destabilize really vulnerable regions and populations. And that is not good for our national security.
Well, it's also going to cause problems with our allies, because we happen to be the largest donors to the United Nations. This is essentially pulling our money out of the system, and it's going to cause some hard feelings, it's going to cause some hardships, and of course, it'll leave areas that are already prone to conflict and bad situations. I mean, these are people who are going through a lot of stuff that we help out, and I think it's basic humanitarian needs, and I think it's actually helped us to have that going, obviously, because it keeps our interests stable in certain regions. It is something that we've always used in post-conflict situations or even during conflict. So I found that very troubling as well. I'd have to agree on that one.
It's like we're trying to have a military untethered by political aims. What are we going to do with the military? I mean, the military is there to try and enforce a political strategy, or it's how it's supposed to work. And now we're just kind of cutting down anything that could be used to develop a political strategy to the bone. And we're still beating up the military. Like, is it going to make policy for itself now?
I would talk about extremism. I don't see why we find it so hard to balance things. I mean, I understand the need to vamp up the military. We have to attack. We have to deal with ISIS and all of those different factors. But why these areas? I mean, this goes hand in hand. Ask the military. It's the most difficult situation when they leave a conflict zone and they're trying to do post-conflict development and security and all of that. And you're cutting down the support that's coming to the local population. That's actually, you know, antithetical to what they're trying to achieve.
Well, I feel like, you know, the cuts in the funding is going to lead to greater conflict, which then might mean we need more military. I mean, maybe they're creating a system in which there will be a need for more U.S. military involvement in other parts of the world. I think we're going to see the building of more bases. We're going to see just more military aggression and presence across the world of U.S. forces. And you know, there's even the likelihood that they're going to cut all programs, anything to do with climate change, reproductive health. And by the way, before the inauguration even happened, I have friends and colleagues who work on those issues in many of these agencies. And they were getting requests from the transition team that, you know, we want a list of all the programs and all the people working in these programs, including people even working on countering violent extremism. So people kind of saw this coming. But when you are getting rid of those kinds of programs, you're going to see booms in populations in places that cannot sustain it. You're going to see, more devastating climate change. I mean, like you're going to help create the conditions that are certainly going to cause more conflict and suffering. And I'm very, very worried by this. So,
Well, in a more direct way, it also affects the most vulnerable populations who are actually, you know, sustaining themselves on this aid. That's what's heartbreaking. It's like, why can't we balance it to some degree? But I think a lot of Republicans have issues with this.
Well, see, that's the ethical argument. That's the ethical argument. But I'm trying to appeal to the national security argument here, too. But yeah, you might be right, though, Sarah, that I'm hoping the GOP leadership is like, this doesn't work for us.
Well, the military doesn't seem happy with it either. I mean, they're happy for the increased funding.
But because I'm telling you, that's their main thing. It's like we're in a conflict zone. We've just finished the operation itself. And then we need to be, you know, nurturing people in the local areas. We need to be getting support in them. We need to be providing things that the basic population, basic things that the population needs. And if we're not able to do that across regions, and it's not just always localized, you have to look at the entire region because people seep into other areas to cause conflict, that they're fluid in that sense, then it's going to be harder for the military in the long run if we don't have something that works hand in hand with the military.
Yeah, they're not cheering on the destruction of the state agency.
All right, so we're going to move on to one of the big, major, really kind of, I think, epic things that happened this week, and that was the James Comey, who is director of FBI, and the NSA director, Mike Rogers, House Intelligence Committee hearing took place. I think the president was tweeting in the hours before this or the days before this because he knew he was going to be basically discredited some of his claims. And that's kind of what happened. And some of the major takeaways were that the FBI has been engaged in an ongoing investigation of Trump associate contacts with Russia since July of last year, 2016. So since the campaign, way before the election, they are looking at whether there's any coordination between any Trump associates and staff and Russian agents or entities, and whether any crimes have been committed. And I also thought it was kind of big that Comey specifically said that the Department of Justice has authorized him to make this statement. So, you know, at this point, from what I know, I think the Russia count is at how many folks do we have going now that we know have actual ties to both the administration and to Russia? We have Paul Manafort. We have Roger Stones. You have Jeff Sessions, Mike Flynn, Carter Page. So what do you think about this? I mean, and the other big takeaway was that, I mean, him and it was so odd because the president was tweeting during the hearing, and then he completely misstated what Comey said. But basically, both Stone and Comey testified that there was no evidence of any Obama wiretaps, completely undermining, you know, that crazy tweet from a couple weeks ago. Sarah, did you watch the hearing?
Bits and pieces of it. Of course, there's so much to keep up with. I'm always finding myself logging in every 2 seconds to different stories. Yeah, and honestly, to me, it's like a juvenile situation where you have, you know, a kid in a playground has been caught doing something really egregious, and then to deflect from his actions, he's kind of like putting out these tweets about somebody else doing something bad. So this wiretap thing, you know, I the credibility of it, and then putting the timing of that along with all this stuff being found on Russia, to me, it's just correlated in the sense that it's kind of not a red herring, but it's like we're putting our energies into, you know, hearings on the wiretap rather than actually looking into the substantive stuff.
And the leaks. There was, to me, the most shocking divide to see it in action in lifetime was just the fact that the real problem here, apparently, from many of the GOP is that there were leaks of this information, which is a problem. It's a real issue that needs to be addressed, but it's not the problem that was currently critical and currently the subject of the hearing.
Yeah, definitely. I think the bigger problem here is that we might have Russian agents in the White House. I mean, to me, that's kind of terrifying. But I do think if since July, why do you think it's taken this long, though? I mean, to me, that's a long time to investigate and not have decided yet whether anything criminal has happened.
Because we're getting love bombed by several issues every day. This stuff all gets stretched out and put on different lists of priorities every day. That's how I feel sometimes. I feel like there's such a barrage of issues every day.
Right, but not for the FBI, not for the team, not for the team that's like investigating.
Are you kidding? I think the FBI's got so much on its plate, just looking at this and looking at other issues. I mean, and these things, like I said, take time because you got to find credible evidence. You got to pack it down before you say anything. You can't just go around tweeting stuff, you know. You have to actually have facts to back what you're saying. So I think it takes time anyway, but given the urgency of these you know, I feel like it's still going to take a while to find out what the truth is.
And then there's the political sensitivities, too. I mean, during the election, it was a presidential election, and there's a candidate being investigated for foreign ties. And that's a very sensitive matter that they, I think, probably correctly, maybe in hindsight, will judge differently. But at the time, I can see why they want to keep it quiet and not try and interfere with the election by announcing the investigation. I don't understand why that didn't apply to Hillary.
Right.
That's the big problem here with everything, is that given what they knew about Trump and the fact they were actively investigating him for what, for working for a foreign agent, I can't wrap my head around the fact they went ahead and announced the nothing that they were doing against Hillary. And there's very good reason to believe that would change the election. Comey's decision there did alter history.
I think it did make a difference. Certainly it did. And I, you know, one thing, the other thing I noted with the GOP, other than the leaks, is that they kept harping on this, you know, well, do you think that there was direct interference with the election from Russia? Meaning, like, did they change the vote counts and stuff like that? And of course, there's no evidence to that. The legislators kept asking this question, trying to make the point that's almost like, so what? So what if there were these Russian contacts and they were trying really hard? We accept that. But if they didn't change the outcome, then so what? And I just find that to be a ridiculous argument. I almost feel like, does the GOP not consider Russia to be a hostile, like, nation to us anymore? Are we just in a different era, you know?
No, like, I think if you could look back to the Yahoo account hacking that just got revealed by the DOJ, and where you actually have indictments being handed out, I mean, this plays into the whole fact that we're just not safe from all this hacking and wiretapping and cyber, you know, we're vulnerable in a cyber space. And so I'm wondering if they're trying to link that whole Yahoo hacking thing with how it is state-sponsored, you know, intrusion into our electronic systems. This is a big deal. And how far is that related to all these other the accusations linked with the administration? So I think they have to be careful, and they also have to draw, you know, just connect all the dots and look at this as a big picture, as what role is Russia playing in our internal dealings?
Well, if there's any doubt that Russia is not a friend to us, just this morning I was reading a report that a U.S. general is saying that Russia is actually providing support and arms to the Taliban in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, and that's a place we might send our soldiers back again. I mean, like, this is a U.S. general saying this. And so I don't know. I just feel like we have legislators who are kind of losing sight of who is really the enemy here. And by the way, quickly,
Russia is not our friend. I mean, the intelligence community is united behind the fact that Russia did interfere in our election and attempt to undermine democracy. And for a while, or at least publicly, they weren't saying the purpose of that. They now say it was to elect Donald Trump. But even take that part aside, just the bare fact that Russia was trying to undermine democracy in America means they are not our friend. They are a dire threat to us. They are economically weak, but they have found essentially cyber guerrilla warfare as a way they can still act out in the world and have an effect despite their small economy.
I know that our listeners of the 45th podcast are not here to be entertained. You guys are here to be informed. And now more than ever, it's important to have knowledge, to stay informed, and to keep learning about what's happening in the world across a range of topics. In this week's episode, we talk about an issue that is going to have lasting repercussions for this country, for all Americans, for generations, and that is the Supreme Court nominee. Now, I am a lawyer, but I have a confession. I don't know as much about the Supreme Court as I wish I did. And that's why I'm really excited about this week's sponsor, The Great Courses Plus. If you don't know about them, well, The Great Courses Plus is a video lecture service that's online that offers over 8,000 engaging video lectures presented by award-winning experts over a huge range of topics, from law, history, science, how to cook, take better pictures. New courses get added all the time, but this week, you know what I'm listening to? I'm listening to their lecture series on the history of the Supreme Court. It's a fascinating series. It's got 36 lectures taught by Professor Peter Irons of the University of California of San Diego. He's a Harvard Law graduate and brings to life the incredibly rich history of one of the most important institutions in the United States. You might not know it, but the U.S. Supreme Court was established in 1789, and as you can imagine, a lot has happened since. And Professor Irons does a masterful job taking us through, year by year, issue by issue, the incredible history of the Supreme Court. from the most famous justices to the most important issues that impact us even today. Privacy laws, civil rights amendments, abortion, Watergate, affirmative action, it is all in there, our entire legal history in this amazing lecture series. I really encourage our listeners to sign up for the Great Courses Plus to deepen and broaden your knowledge and information. As a listener of the 45th podcast, you will get a free trial if you sign up by using our special URL. So grab your pencil. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Again, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. And the amazing thing is you can stream these videos from your smartphone, your tablet, your laptop, or your TV. So sign up now for the Great Courses Plus. You will love it. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/45 and start learning today.
On the heels of this hearing, there was a little bit of a brouhaha with Nunes. The announcement that, well, I still know what happened there. Rabia, do you have like a good summary of that whole event?
I do.
Devin
Nunes is the chair of the House Intel Committee. He was the chair of the hearing that was taking place. Just the weirdest thing happened. 2 days after the hearing, he pops up at the White House and he gives the president some kind of briefing. Then he comes out into the lawn and gives a press conference saying he briefed the president that he has been shown information. He's been shown some kind of evidence by not the White House, but some investigative agency.
He won't say if it's the White House.
I thought he made it clear that it wasn't during the press conference. But you know what? You're right. It could be, I don't believe anything at this point. It could have been the White House calling him to show him something. But the first he said, there's evidence showing that there have been, the FBI has been investigating members of the Trump administration after the election and has intercepted calls in which they U.S. people who are part of the administration have been identified, but that they were actually identified instead of being unidentified, because these investigative reports should not have the names of those U.S. people. That's a policy unless they are being implicated, in the investigation itself, because the purpose of these particular investigations was under FISA just to collect communications from foreign entities, basically, and then the collateral and evidence that gets collected is like the U.S. people they're in contact with. But the investigation is not about the U.S. person; it's about the foreign entity. But he had not basically briefed like the Democratic members of the committee, who were really pissed off. Then he had to go apologize to them. He had apparently told some of the GOP leadership, including Paul Ryan, that he was going to go and do this, that he was going to talk to the president, and he was going to have a press conference. He was apparently advised not to do it, but he was so upset at seeing this evidence that he did it anyways. Now there's been a bit of a rollback where he said, Nunes is saying, well, actually, those people, the U.S. persons, were not identified in the reports. So I'm not exactly sure what he was upset about. Nobody yet knows what that evidence is because...
Well, he's walked it back, too. He's also now saying that he isn't sure if that actually involved collection of Trumper's associates. We have no idea what he found or where he found it, and he won't share it. So,
I mean, there's that.
We know nothing.
And then there's the fact that he ran off to talk to the president about it. I mean, he is supposed to be part of...
The oversight.
Right. Yeah. How is he... And I think this is the bigger concern here, in a way, is that he cannot be an impartial investigator. You know, he and many people are calling for him to step down as a chair of this committee.
So his stated justification, he said why he did it, is because obviously the president's been taking a lot of heat in the media. So he wanted to make sure the president had this thing that could possibly help them in the media. I mean, he was helping, he was not denying that he's helping the president here.
Well, he was trying to help
in a very inappropriate
way. And the president, by the way, and many right-wing media outlets took this opportunity to start publishing reports and tweets saying that, oh, the president's been vindicated. There was wiretapping. And none of that is actually true.
That's the thing, though. Like, these headlines have an effect. I mean, the fact that... So right now, we don't know anything still. All we know is that Nunes did something very bizarre by going to the president, who he has oversight over in this issue, or he's supposed to be acting like an investigatory role. So we know he acted inappropriately that way. We don't know anything else. We don't know what he found or where he found it. And yet the headlines have people who are, you know, smart, reasonable people paying attention, believing that there's now proof Obama wiretapped Trump. There is none. There's nothing there that's at all supported that conclusion in any way. But the headlines say it has, and that's the takeaway. People who are paying attention a little, but not as in-depth with this as mean people who are obsessed like us.
Well, Bill O'Reilly had Newt Gingrich on and asked him, well, do you think this, like, you know, vindicates the president? And do you think what the president tweeted was accurate? And Newt Gingrich's response was 99.5%, if not 100% accurate. So it's even beyond the headlines. You've got major figures like Bill O'Reilly actually, you know, propagating a complete and utter lie based on. But Nunes did create enough smoke that it confused a lot of people. But,
and
you know,
the GOP was fundraising on it, too. They sent out a fundraiser saying, we now know the president was right. He was being, like, spied on by Obama. Help us defeat, like, this whatever's going on by giving us money.
This all plays into that, this whole, you know, the feeling that we've gotten since the administration's been in power of having, you know, information being skewed or presented differently, or entirely differently sometimes by different outlets and different sources. And right. then the breaches of protocol, and then the fact that, you know, loyalty is always in question and things are being hacked and people are being, you know, exposed to information they shouldn't be. It's actually very troubling because it makes everything look really messy, and it kind of makes you feel a little insecure about what the heck's going on.
Something else happened about a week ago, and that was we finally saw some tax returns, right, Susan?
There was an interesting sort of development when Rachel Maddow had on her show 2 pages of tax returns from Trump. It was just 2 pages from 2005 from his 1040. So people were disappointed because they thought that the pages didn't show that much, and they didn't. But I think the more interesting issue here is where they came from. On Maddow's show, they did discuss the possibility, although they possibly didn't go into much detail as they might have. But I think there is a really strong case to be made here that Trump himself leaked these. It's by far the most coherent explanation I've seen for where these documents came from.
Because I was going to ask you that, Susan. I mean, is it, there was an uproar about his something so personal being released to the public that way. So is it allowed? I mean, as lawyers, do you guys know where the statute of limitations is on revealing somebody's personal taxes out in public like that?
Well, if he did it, it's totally fine. And the other thing is, these aren't filed taxes. These were not documents that ever went to the government.
Right.
They're not signed. They're not a tax return that the government itself would have. And we're just basically assuming that Trump was telling the truth when he said that's really what he paid in taxes. And they say, so of course, Trump comes out with all these, like, you know, angry statements like, how dare they leak my tax returns? But they don't hurt him because they show he did pay $38 million in taxes that year under the AMT. And they show that his income was, I forget what the numbers, but it was, I mean, he had an income that year, which is interesting, though, because that's like right when his casino thing was going bust. And he had a few other deals that were falling apart, like Chicago. But I think that when they were suggesting on the show that Trump himself might have done this, because Trump has a history of leaking his own issues, own documents when he wants to, I can't think of anything else that could explain it here. And my fear about where they came from is that actually what we're seeing with these two tax returns, or 2 pages of tax returns, is stuff that was produced in discovery, in a litigation that happened back in 2006 and 2007 concerning Trump's lawsuit for defamation against Tim O'Brien, who wrote a book saying that Trump's total net worth was about $250 million or so. Trump didn't like that, so he sued and said it was a lie. He didn't win in the end, but it took quite a few years to, you know, sort out. But in that litigation, one of the things that was produced were the 2005 tax returns. Of course, even then, Trump's production was very limited. And one of the letters from the defense side, from Tim O'Brien's side, discussing this issue, because they're writing to the court saying, hey, can you please make Trump give us his financial information? I mean, he's claiming the whole basis of the lawsuit is that we wrongfully claim that he didn't have as much money, but he won't show us any documents to prove he actually has that money. So what they wrote it to the court is, it is worth noting that Trump's reluctance to provide sufficient information to verify his net worth, the core issue in this case, is nothing new. Despite the author's repeated requests for financial information relating to Trump's net worth in connection with the book, Trump provided him with information that was completely inadequate for estimating Trump's wealth. In effect, Trump cherry-picked the documents that he provided to the author and demanded that he blindly accept Trump's representations regarding his net worth.
Sounds like a pattern of behavior. I mean, is it not enough to be a millionaire? Or I mean, like, is it so important that people think he's a billionaire?
What is he arguing is his net worth?
He says $10 billion, but, I mean, that $10 billion figure is, I don't think he's even trying to be serious about it because it's got a bunch of numbers that have nonsense basis for them. The official estimates are about like $3.4 billion, and it's too much to address today, but I have some serious doubts about that as well. He's definitely a millionaire. I mean, he's definitely rich, but he is nowhere near what he's ever claimed to be. He could actually have proved this. The litigation, a good place to prove it. Instead, in another letter to the court, the defense wrote, discussing all the redactions and the failure of Trump to produce the basic financial data that it needed, the plaintiff, Trump, then proceeds essentially to re-argue the court's prior orders regarding the production of Trump's financial information, including the November 3rd, 2006 order requiring Trump to produce his 2005 tax return, subject only to redaction of personal information, an order that Trump has completely disregarded. In its November 3, 2006 order, the court ordered Trump to produce his 2005 tax return subject only to the redaction of personal information, such as alimony and charitable contributions. But, as the court knows, prior to producing the return 1 week late, plaintiff redacted all but eight numbers, including all financial data on the Schedule C, profit or loss from business, D, capital gains and losses, and E, supplemental income and loss. In other words, Trump did produce basically all of his 2005 tax returns in this litigation, but he redacted everything but eight numbers from it.
And it was a 700-page tax return.
Yeah.
And it wasn't eight pages, it was eight numbers, which is crazy.
Still, if things were going to be leaked from the defense side, from Tim O'Brien's side, they had better stuff to leak. And Trump does complain in his deposition in that case about how he finally had to give his tax returns over. And he says, he's asked, question, you've given your tax return discovery? Answer, I think so. Didn't we give the one, you'll have to ask my lawyers, but I thought we gave them 1 year, the year it's in question. Question, and you gave that under a confidentiality order, correct? Answer, yes, a very strong confidentiality order, because you don't want tax returns to go out. But tax returns don't really have anything to do with net worth. So that's Trump saying that, like, yeah, he made sure that before the tax returns were produced in discovery that he had a strong confidentiality order. And also, by it doesn't even matter because he's correct. It doesn't have anything to do with net worth. So anyway, all that shows is that those documents and the 1040 in its unredacted form would have been present in the O'Brien litigation, but O'Brien wouldn't have leaked them. One, he was under an order to keep them confidential, and two, they don't hurt Trump. The ones Trump gave over didn't support a case against Trump, so he had no reason to release them. The only person with any kind of motive to let them out in public is Trump himself. The other reason to think it's the same ones as the ones from the litigation is that at one point in the court transcripts, the court's talking about the financial information that Trump did release, and the court makes a joke and says, I think I'm going to hire Trump's accountant because he only paid $38,000 in tax that year. And the plaintiff's attorney corrects him and says, oh, it says $38 million. Well, that's the exact same number we see on the 1040 that was on Maddow's show. So it's definitely the same outcome or the same result in the documents and litigation, the ones that were on the show. And I think there's a good case to be made that, yeah, that it's the same document. And the reason it's postmarked from Westchester, which is where Trump's vacation property was, is because someone connected to Trump who was there dropped him in the mail.
It was, really? I had missed that.
Question for you, Susan. Is it, I don't expect you to know, you know, if it's an international law issue, but is it really hard to gauge someone's net worth when they have a lot of financial dealings overseas? Because I know that there's, you know, with domestic law, it's really hard. Like, for instance, take the instance of a divorce case. If somebody's sending money overseas, those funds are not something that can be tracked necessarily or exposed for what they are, because once they're out, right? So is he having trouble disclosing his net worth because there's just so much going on overseas as well? I mean, I'm not trying to give, I'm just trying to understand, how do you figure out someone's net worth when they have so many foreign dealings and foreign, you know, projects in different countries, whether they go kaput or not? The question is, how do you figure that out? That's a lot of bookkeeping. That's a lot of work for an accountant.
So in the numbers that they put out there of what Trump's net worth really is, those are basically, I think, 99% domestic numbers, because we don't have access to the foreign information. We have a few details from his FEC filings. We know that he does have or did have some land in, I think, Dominican Republic. But otherwise, again, you're right. We don't know what kind of money he's getting overseas. We don't know what kind of foreign business dealings he has going on. But that's not the reason we can't calculate his net worth. That's because Trump won't give over information we need to do it. But what it does prove is that when Trump wants to confirm his tax records, he can, because he did for Maddow when she asked him. He's like, oh, how dare you release those accurate tax returns that show I paid $38 million in taxes last year.
I mean, look, to be honest, they didn't protest too much about this. I don't think there was any angry tweets about this tax return being leaked, if it was actually...
Oh, there were some.
There were two or three that I saw.
Yeah. Oh, really? He was putting on a show. He was super pissed about this. But why would he be pissed about it? Like, why would anyone try to hurt Trump release these?
Yeah. And that was two pages without any schedules that just showed very little.
Not signed. And for all we know, we're not actually the ones that went to the government.
It's amazing how he's been guarding his... this is not, like, new. This has been ongoing for years. I mean, the litigation shows that for a long, long time, he's been guarding his taxes very closely. So there's got to be a lot of great stuff in there.
This is part and parcel of who we've chosen or elected as president. This person is a complicated figure. He's got business dealings all over the world. He has done stuff that the average person hasn't. He's not like the run-of-the-mill candidate who's actually been, you know, raised or kind of trained to be sort of a leader and is, you know, has a traditional background of service.
Public service.
So this is going to be really complicated because...
No, it doesn't have to be that complicated. It actually could be very simple.
It doesn't have to. You're right.
He didn't have to, but it's not that he could have made it simple. He has chosen not to. I mean, Romney had just as many, if not more, issues in that regard. And he did come... He hesitated. He shouldn't have. But he did come clean on all that. And Trump should have too. And I think that we're going to very much regret that we let a candidate get through the whole primary system and the general election without ever revealing his financial ties.
Yeah, establishment Republican. So yeah,
he's not an establishment much of anything. But I will say that I do think if anybody is looking at those tax returns and trying to figure out what they could show in terms of his ties, his liabilities, it's probably the FBI. It's probably the intelligence agencies. They actually can get access to that. They can just do it by, I guess, getting some kind of subpoena warrant. I don't know what mechanism it would take. But I'm assuming they can do it without anybody knowing, without Trump himself knowing that they have been able to get these documents. Because if those documents do show, let's say, payments to certain entities that could help make or break a case, it would make sense to me that they're looking at them, right?
Oh, like the only reason we even know that Trump was getting money from a group that he claimed he was not is the FEC filings. He was forced to say that for his Azerbaijan tower, he was getting money from a company that was owned by his alleged business partner's uncle. He was an MP in Azerbaijan because he had to give a company name, which did not match the person that he says he's doing business with.
Yeah, and also, you know, once you get into overseas dealings, you're dealing more with the CIA because that's their purview. The FBI is more local, but of course they do assist in a supportive role in as much as it's connected to domestic stuff. But yeah, when you go overseas, it's CIA.
Really, I think this is a DOJ issue. I mean, again, with Sessions, it's not going to go anywhere, but it's a DOJ problem.
I have been having most anxiety this past week over the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch before the Easter recess on April 7th for Congress. So, you know, let's go over how important this is to the U.S. Conservatives also regard this as a top issue on the agenda. Certainly evangelicals who turned out in big numbers to support Trump based on his promise. So, I don't know how much you guys support polls, but there's an interesting fact from a poll conducted that was revealed in Time magazine. But in an NBC election exit poll, 22% of voters said the Supreme Court was the quote-unquote most important factor in their decision. And that's up from 7% in the 2008 election. And that same poll showed that 27% of Trump's voters said the Supreme Court nominee was quote-unquote the most important factor in their decision, compared to 19% of Clinton voters. So Trump on abortion was the biggest Google search. It was up by 4,000% on November 8th. So it was the most Googled issue on election day. So it's important to people. And of course, that was an exit poll, and we don't know how people feel now, given all the competing issues we have with healthcare and stuff. But there were like essentially four important cases that were on the table when Scalia died, and those are in the area of immigration reform, affirmative action, abortion, and healthcare. So this is an important thing, and I honestly have been a little annoyed at the Democrats because I think Gorsuch should be voted in. It's a political power play, and it's very disruptive because, I mean, I can understand the argument.
So you know the response there, that is that the GOP threatened to never nominate or never vote on a Supreme Court nominee from Hillary if she was elected. They were saying they're going to go 4 years without anyone.
Right. So Ted Cruz said in February 2016 that he was going to filibuster any of the nominees coming from the other side. And I know that this is a game that both sides play, but honestly, this guy is liked by both sides. I mean, he's been he's been there for like 10 years as a 10th District Circuit Court judge. I mean,
on the other side, I have no problem with conservative justice in the Supreme Court. I think we absolutely need, I mean, if I could run the world, I would choose as balanced as possible lineup on Supreme Court. I think that's very important. In a normal world, I would say go ahead and vote for him, like whatever. But I have definitely lost confidence in this guy. I'm not thrilled that he's the pick. He's kind of like a low rent Scalia, really.
Okay. Look, so it's been established that from his...
That's some serious shade, Susan.
Well, his primary pool of donors from his election to the federal judge position showed that he was probably more conservative than 87% of all the other federal judges. So he'd be second to, say, Clarence Thomas would be. But he is someone we can trust to uphold a constitution. And he's had a really good report from the ABA about 500 people giving statements that gave him a good report. So my arguments are, look, I'm a fan of Antonin Scalia, but I know a lot of people aren't. So they're afraid that, you know, this is going to be a repeat of Antonin Scalia, but I don't think he's exactly Antonin Scalia. So I think that's an irrational argument. We don't have a lame duck president right now. We actually have someone in office. So we have to accept the reality that we have a Republican president. We have a conservative Congress. And this is the type of candidate that will be out there for nomination. And it's not like this is a tiebreaker vote. I mean, it just balances everything out. And none of the Democrats opposes nomination as a federal judge for the 10th district the first time. If they had issues with him, they would have brought it up then. But the other thing is, to what degree do judges, you know, they're trained to put the law before their position. And I can understand that it, you know, people worry about the political leanings, but it does influence their interpretation in so much as how they approach the law. But I think they can separate it from their political beliefs.
So that's one thing I actually have kind of been disappointed in him about, is that he makes this big show about like praising judges who decide constitutional legal issues in a way that conflicts with their own personal leanings. And like, if he's praising a judge, it's because it's a liberal judge who's like having a decision that has a conservative right. sort of political bent. But you look at his actual political beliefs and his actual like legal judicial record, they are very closely aligned. Like this dude's interpretation of the Constitution basically is a boilerplate support of his moral beliefs.
Well, we're gonna go through that real quick. But honestly, what Chuck Schumer is doing is kind of annoying to me, because he's kind of trying to align him with Trump and Trump's ideologies and politics, and saying he isn't convinced that he'll act independently. And what's interesting is, you know, 3 years ago, the Senate, and that was Harry Reid, voted to not allow filibusters in Senate motions for federal judges and executive nominees, except in the area of Supreme Court nominations. So now we're stuck with, is the GOP going to use the nuclear option, which requires 51 votes to end the filibuster? Right now, we have 52 Republicans already that support him, but the filibuster would require 60 votes for cloture. So I think it's really annoying, because you're going to have a conservative nominee.
Yeah,
but right.
Yeah, but you're going to have a conservative nominee regardless. So is this the guy you want, or what else do you want? You know, that's the question.
Well, I think, you know what, Sarah, I think that's actually, of all the things you've said, maybe the most compelling argument. And I think it was, I think Lindsey Graham brought this up during the hearing, and I can't remember if it was him, but I'm pretty sure when he was addressing Gorsuch, and he said, you know, he was really worried about who Trump would nominate, maybe somebody from TV. And so maybe the most compelling argument is like, this might be one of the best options that comes out of a Trump nomination, is somebody like him. And that's the only thing that makes me hesitate, because look, I am concerned. I am concerned about the impact his appointment would have on reproductive rights and just so many other issues. But then I think, well, of course, there is not going to be a single nominee that's going to come out of the Trump administration that is not going to have that same kind of impact. So I'm a little bit confused on this guy.
Well, yeah. I'd like to blow that notion that he's not going to be judicially independent out of the water. I just don't think that's really unfair.
No, but you cannot be. Look. You cannot distance yourself from your own interpretations, right? That's why you end up with judges who, on the same issue, come to different conclusions. Is because, and maybe they're all exercising their independent. They're not being partisan or anything, but they just have a certain ideological framework, they have a certain deeply held personal beliefs, that is going to inform how they interpret the law.
Yeah, and that's the conservative agenda right now. That's what he comes with. But the point is that, you know, he's already stated that he's going to be that way. And here's what Gorsuch had to say about when he was asked by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa whether he'd be able to oppose the president, maintain judicial independence.
I'd like to have you describe in any way you want to what judicial independence means, and specifically tell us whether you'd have any trouble ruling against a president who appointed you.
So I take the process, the judicial process, very seriously. And I go through it step by step and keeping an open mind through the entire process as best I humanly can. And I leave all the other stuff at home. And I make a decision based on the facts and the law. Those are some of the things judicial independence means to me.
So my question is, why oppose him? Just because you think he's Trump's choice and he might be a Scalia type? Trump promised on the campaign trail that he wants to nominate someone close to the Scalia's image and actions, but also that he would get a judge who would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. And he said that before, but I wanted to go through with you guys, because you're the lawyers here, what his stances have been, to see, you know, is there any legitimacy to even insinuating that he would overturn Roe v. Wade? He's saying outright that he won't, because it has a precedent.
So, okay, I think you got to separate, there's two separate distinct issues here, right? One is like Gorsuch is a nominee, and one is the broader political issue here. So just imagine two independent don't call them Democrat and Republican, just like two different opposing sides. What happens if one side constantly abuses the process and constantly refuses to play by the rules, and the other side constantly responds by saying, well, you didn't follow the rules, but we're going to now because that's the right thing to do. And they consistently give exactly what the other side wants and never, ever get processed back in return.
Right.
Like, that's not a stable situation. Like, this long-term cannot last. We cannot have a world, we can't have the United States, where the Republicans are constantly saying, we are not going to obey the presumed structure of the Constitution and do our job and vote on nominees from a Democratic president. But the Democrats have to vote for ours.
You can flip that, too. And you can say that I feel the Democrats are kind of maligning him in the sense that if he doesn't appear to be cookie cutter, put into the box on the opposing side and typical GOP at his approach to everything, then he's just, you know, the sinister being who could be very pro-Trump. I think that's really, that's uncalled for. And I think that's what they're trying to do. It's part of this whole...
That's what I'm saying. There's two different sides. Like, there's the whole, even aside from the nominee himself, like... It doesn't matter who he is, there is a good structural argument to be made that it is right to push back against it. Then there's the objections to him as an actual Supreme Court justice. I think it's worth separating the two.
Right, right. Yeah, they're two different issues. But if their response is, we're going to punish you the way you've been punishing us, we're going to like use the same kind of political tricks and block any kind of progress, then where are we? Then, I mean, how does that help either? I mean, like, I guess, what is the answer here? Like, how do you deal with this?
I think the Democrats have it's a tough situation. I think that their instinct is right to want to uphold the commitment to rule of law. And even if the Republicans aren't going to obey norms that we've respected for 250 years, their instinct has been, you know what, these norms are important. Even though they're being shredded right now, we're going to push back in some way to try and respect the process itself. I would like to see them getting more reach back from the other side, which is not happening. Look, the fact that they were all saying, the Republicans were saying they were not going to vote on any Supreme Court justice that was put forth by President Hillary, that shows how broken it was. Because that's not sustainable. That cannot happen. There's no constitutional provision that says only Republican presidents get to nominate Supreme Court justices. So at the end of the day, what also comes back to me, I have this hopefully irrational fear. I don't like how long we've gone with an 8-justice court. We're definitely heading to very complicated legal times. And for me, this whole one justice down on the court feels like sort of a third act thing that's going to reappear to hurt us when we're most vulnerable. And what happens if we have a constitutional crisis and a 4-4 split Supreme Court? So for that reason alone, part of me just wants to have a 9th justice on there. Like, whatever the outcome is, at least give us a 5-4 vote when that crucial crisis happens.
Yeah, and I think this is the guy. honestly. And I think the one of the key issues in the Supreme Court is always abortion, right? And I asked my kids this question. I was like, why are we so obsessed with the abortion issue? Like, how rampant is it in this country? And I realized it's not so much the issue itself. It's the fact that how far can the law go in interfering in such a personal thing in a person's life, right? And the question is, I think the Supreme Court's role is to adjudicate something that obviously state and federal judges can't, but it gets into a personal space that really sets a precedent for how far.
Yeah.
So my question, I guess, with this is, he's already said in the hearing, I mean, why is everyone having a problem? He said in the hearing that he supports a precedent set by Roe v. Wade that was set 43 years ago. And then Dick Durbin used his book, I think Gorsuch wrote a book called The Future of Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia, in which he said the intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. So Dick Durbin asked him, well, how do you justify that statement with the view on a woman's right to an abortion? And he said that, you know, and this is probably in line with religious beliefs, that a fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment. But he does accept Roe v. Wade as the law of the land. And if he was even asked, if Trump asked him to repeal it, he just said he would walk out the door.
That was as a matter of principle, not as a matter of the substance of the issue, right? He would walk out of the door because he if Trump asked him on any issue, he would walk out. I'm like, that's how I heard that.
I think you're right. I don't think Gorsuch is, I don't think he's meaningfully different in terms of like the final vote from any nominee would be. So I don't think that's,
yeah.
I mean, Gorsuch 2.0 probably is going to vote the same way. I will say personally, I'm not impressed by the guy. I mean, he's a very impressive, smart, intelligent man and all that. But in terms of Supreme Court justices, I don't see him as being like one of the, you know, one of the ones I remember.
I didn't think it was right for Feinstein to grill him the way she did. She uses his two daughters as examples and stuff. I just think they're just trying to create issues when you know the guy's saying he's pretty mellow about following the law when he needs to apply it. And I think they're just like beating a dead horse and trying to just get something out of this to delay it, honestly.
But that's their job. Isn't their job to like closely question nominees and find out where they actually stand?
Right.
I mean, a thorough grilling is following norms and following the law. Like, that's their job.
Well, it's not thorough grilling. It's the way she's doing it. I mean, I feel it makes it look like, you know, she's questioning how he would handle things. And his record's pretty clear, and he's saying it as well. So, I don't know. And the fact that, you know, they keep harping on, can you be judicially independent? I mean, he's done that on immigration stuff. He's done that on a lower level in the circuit courts already. So he supported undocumented illegal immigrants in one instance. And he's for something called the Chevron deference, which I think Antonin Scalia was actually against. And that is that, you know, he's against letting agencies, federal and state agencies, determine laws on stuff to do with immigration and things like and religious liberty and stuff. He believes that actually judges should be making those decisions. So in some ways, you know, he really takes very seriously the application of the law, and he will keep a check on Donald Trump. If he is a person that supports the Chevron, is against the Chevron. It basically means he's not going to leave it up to Trump's agencies to decide what the law is. He wants the judicial system to determine that.
I do think you're right there. I don't actually think that from my take on him, I don't think he's actually going to be like politically protective of everything that Trump and, you know, his henchmen want to do. But I do want to say that, you know, you keep saying that, you know, he's going to be different to the law. The law remains the law until the Supreme Court changes the law, right? I mean, like, sure, Roe v. Wade, you know, if it's challenged again, he could be the person who helps to change it. And that's other issues too. It's the law now. And of course, he's going to be deferential to the president, the precedent of the law right now. But that law can change, which is what happens all the time.
You could argue that with any type of...
I think it goes back to the whole process. It goes back to the game theory of how you respond to when one party refuses to play by the rules, refuses to play by like the norms they've played by for centuries. How does the other party institutionally respond to that? And it's a tough question. I think there's not really one right answer there at all. But I do think the idea that sort of roll over and just happily vote in whatever is offered by the Republicans doesn't help either side. There has to be pushback. There has to be consequences for the kind of obstructionary actions that the Republicans were taking. are threatening to take.
I could see why Rabia would mention what she did about, you know, you never know once they're in power how, or once they're sitting up there as justices, how they'd interpret it once the precedent has already been set. But you know that he's also an originalist like Scalia, which means that he interprets the law in a kind of a stricter way where he's looking literally at the text and it's not a very, you know, malleable thing. But I can rest assured that the issue is going to be voted on generally the same way as Scalia, but I do think that he's going to be a little bit less hardline or dogmatic in his approach to it. And in that sense, I think he's going to be good.
I mean, he defended torture. Can we talk about that? I mean,
the national security bit. Yeah, I get that. I get that he kind of gave Secretary Condoleezza Rice at the time, who was going around defending the detention system that we had in place at 9/11 around that time. But I would like to say in his defense that that was a different era in our understanding of terrorism. And I think we were all on, you know, we're all on the defensive. We're all up there. I mean, it was up on the Richter scale, how everyone was being alert and trying to figure out how to handle this stuff. So I think given everything that's going on, he's going to be more nuanced in his approach.
This is a different era too, though. This is the era in which the president has said that I would not just kill terrorists, I would kill their families too. And so I do continue to be concerned that, that he is going to be much more permissive with what he allows, you know, our powers, like, you know, how violent, how extreme our powers can be in terms of not just detention, but like, you know, interrogation and punishment and dealing with terrorists and dealing with these regions and where he would draw the line on torture and waterboarding and all these things. I would be concerned about that because, again, we are again in a different era.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he's going to keep a check on the president on that front. And you can look at his whole track record. I mean, did you watch the hearing part where he talked about the travel ban? And I think he was being pushed to, you know, kind of take a position about whether or not he thought it was something that's legal. And he refused to say anything because obviously it's still being adjudicated. It's something still out there. So he knows that you don't kind of talk about stuff that's out there, but he's being pushed to do it. And I think just because he can't answer something right up blank because, you know, everyone wants a black and white picture to put someone in a box, and that's increasingly the atmosphere that I see everywhere. It's not fair to say that he doesn't, you know, does or doesn't support it. It is what it is. He doesn't want to answer that.
And it's also fair. Yeah, I think it's also fair for him to respond that, look, these are issues I might have to adjudicate. I don't want to take a position on them right now publicly. I think that's fair. Susan, do you support a filibuster by Schumer just to kind of help balance the scales on how they've been manipulating the system? And
I'm really torn on this. Both, part of me is instinctively drawn to the idea of, like, if the norms are falling, reinforce them where you can. On the other hand, I don't think it's a good long-term strategy to just to ignore and not respond in some way to the consistent norm violations going on from the Republicans. So I don't know where I fall necessarily. I think right now, I think the best thing that could happen is to say, look, until we figure out what's going on with the president's FBI investigation for foreign ties and allegedly working the foreign power to influence the outcome of the election, let's not nominate anyone.
But Susan, I thought you just said that you didn't want to wait because it feels weird to have, you know.
It scares me. It does. No, it does. Like, I'm not happy with having, like, I have this, I would hate, I definitely can see this right now, something happening. It goes to Supreme Court. We have a 4-4 split. Supreme Court cannot solve it. We have it's a non-Article 3 solution. So that means what? I do have that fear. At the same time, I don't think it, yeah, basically I have no idea, Rabia.
I'm kind of there with you too, because I keep going back to, well, you know what, I have to say, Gorsuch is better than what I did expect. I do think he's more impressive than who I did expect Trump to nominate.
But
The bar's been set low, and so it's hard for me to kind of figure out because I keep thinking if it's, you know, it could be Judge Judy. I don't know who it would be next.
Judge Judy.
Maybe she'd be better.
Judge Trump. His sister.
John McCain said it best. I think he said it best when he said that the Democrats are acting like a bunch of sour grapes over this nomination and others too.
This is so hypocritical. He would not ever, like, he wouldn't let Hillary nominate anyone for Supreme Court.
Right.
How is that not sour graping?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a two-way street.
There's a lot of babies on both sides.
The final take-home for me, end of the day, I wish we still had Scalia. I think he would be better than Gorsuch by far. But, you know, he's not that objectionable. I think any Republican president could have nominated him. I'm not that concerned about him personally. I am much more concerned with the larger issue in terms of how the parties are going to handle the democratic process going forward.
Yeah. And I would love to explore maybe in the future, maybe with a guest or something, we can talk about like what happened, what happens in a case in which you've got a president under investigation, maybe a president who could face criminal charges or impeachment at some point. What happens to all those appointments and nominations and, you know, do they stand? Should they stand? You know, I mean, like I don't know what the process is there, but it doesn't seem quite right. So I kind of agree with you that until there's some solution with these investigations, that it doesn't, I don't see why this president should have the continued power to issue orders and appoint people and nominate folks.
Because he needs it. He has to have it to keep, I mean, he is the government going. The country right now.
Yeah.
So it has to have, like,
yeah. I don't think, I think at the end of the day, Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed before Easter.
Probably. All right, guys, we're going to wrap up. Thanks to our listeners again. I'm going to give you our number and hope that you guys do call and leave us messages about your thoughts, with your concerns, what maybe suggestions for what you want us to talk about. That number is 202-670-8345, and we will be back in about a week. Thanks so much.
A big shout out and thank you to everybody who makes the 45th possible. To start with, thank you, executive producer Mito Delhan. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting us. Our audio production is by Ray Gaines, and we've been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the 45th Pod, and check out our website at www.45thpod.com. Subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you so much for listening. See you soon.
Should I just get into it, or should we just do kind of like how you guys doing type of thing? What's that?
Sorry, I was busy jury rigging my recording setup.
What?